It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hello, I'm Dave Hendon.
And I'm Michael McMullen.
And I'm Phil Yates.
And welcome to episode 150 of the Snooker Scene podcast. And we're all, the big news is we're all in the same room together. It's not done on Zoom, Skype, none of that. We're actually sat around a table. Michael's been doing the Championship League pool. We're doing the Championship League snooker. We're crossing over. And what a, well, episode 150, who'd have thought? After a year, which that's how long it's been, we're together again.
Yeah, well, you said in the same room. We've not even been doing albums in the same country. So, yeah, great to be here to look ahead to world qualifying, Hendry and White, and all the rest of it.
That's what we're here to talk about. But before that, Phil, we were at the Tour Championship. A great week, certainly for Neil Robertson, but just a really terrific tournament. Obviously, it's the most elite event, obviously, on the circuit because it's just the top eight in the world.
Well, for me, it's a major already. It's only 3 years in to its existence. And it's got that status very quickly because of the fact that you've got the very best in the business there. You've got large prize money, which does matter, let's face it. And you've also got extended matches. Personally, in my eyes, it's taken over from the UK Championship because the UK is now best of 11 frames. It's not where it used to be in terms of prestige because back then it was best of 17 and in the early days, a two-day final.
So yeah, that noise in the background, that shot's being fired at the Triple Crowners. Anyway, carry on.
Oh, yeah. Who brought it up first this week?
I don't deny that the Masters and the World Championship are on a very, very high plane, and they will remain so forevermore, presumably. But I do deny that, you know, the UK is impervious to criticism, not in the sense that it's a great tournament, but it does have challenges. And, of course, when the Saudi Arabian event takes place, with the huge amount of prize money we're going to have there, that will be another serious challenger to its position.
My view on all that is, I think like we're lucky we've got so many big tournaments actually, and I don't actually think they need to be ranked. I mean, the World Championship is number one, obviously. I'd be happy the fact that we've got this big event on the circuit. We had over 1 million on Saturday night watching on ITV4, Ronnie O'Sullivan, Barry Hawkins. You're at the mercy when you've got one match a day of how long they're going to be. The worst of runaways, including the final. Neil Robertson, very interesting, actually, was saying just this morning, Will Snooker interview that they recorded before the final, that, you know, he'd been in a very bad place. He actually basically wanted to go home to Australia. He said he didn't want to even play in the World Championship. He was so homesick, hadn't seen his family for nearly 2 years. His partner, Miller, wrote to the Australian government and they allowed his father to come over. So he arrived the day before the Tour Championship. And obviously that boost, having just been with him, being able to spend time with him, getting rid of the homesickness, has clearly helped him. Ronnie O'Sullivan's fifth defeat in a final. My view on sort of all of that is I don't think it's actually an accident. Yes, he was outplayed, but he had chances early on in that final session. My theory is Ronnie's very good at taking pressure off himself, the way he talks, you know, the way he behaves. Even before the event began, he said he wanted to quit and his cue wasn't proper and all the rest of it. But maybe he's taking that too far. Maybe he's not focused enough, actually, coming into the last session. He was seen pretty quickly before it started taking his stuff to his car, you know. You think, well, that's not really preparing properly. So maybe he's taking that a bit too far. But on the balance of it, Robertson played the best snooker of the week by far.
Yeah, I mean, he was obviously the standout performer. And I think with O'Sullivan, it is interesting to lose 5 ranking finals in one season. I sense it's a little bit like round about 2005, 2006, when he kept talking about how he didn't care whether he won or lost, acted like he didn't care whether he won or lost a lot of the time. He was trying to, I think, maybe take pressure off himself, but in the end, he wasn't helping himself in the later stages of matches. He was almost throwing them as if he could say to himself afterwards, well, I didn't really care anyway. And I just sense a little bit of that attitude actually coming out from him again. I think he's become a little more scared of the very best players. And it's generally been players like that. I know Jordan Brown beat him in the Welsh, but it's generally been players like that who've been beating him in finals. The question about Robertson you raised there, I don't know whether you know this or not, but is the plan for his father then to stay on for the World Championship?
It is, although he always comes over for it. And I've always thought maybe that's because he wasn't here when he won it, his mother came. Maybe that's put pressure on Neil, actually. over the years. The fact he wants his dad to be there to see him. I think it's a bit different this year. I've had an email from Callum Law actually about all this. He said the Tour Championship was another excellent week of snooker, both in terms of the quality on the table and the ITV coverage, which from presenter to pundits to commentators was first class. Thank you. I was pleased to see Neil Robertson win and play so well. Watching Robertson when he's at his best is superb and up there with anybody in the game in terms of quality and entertainment. What was noticeable throughout, and he spoke about it himself, was Robertson trying to play the game on his terms by continuing to be aggressive, taking on long reds, etc. Too often in the past, Robertson has come undone in longer matches against the likes of... That's Phil's phone, of course, it is. He's got no discipline at all. Longer matches against the likes of Selby and Higgins because he's allowed them to dictate how the game was played with long bouts of tactical play. So it's good to see him play the way that suits him best. I also think Robertson is one of the game's great ambassadors, both in terms of the success he's had and the way he conducts himself. Never seems to be any clowning around, disrespecting opponents or complaining about things with Robertson. He comes across as someone who loves snooker, appreciates the game, what the game has given him. And personally, I'm pleased to see him get the rewards for the hard work he puts in, the way he treats the game. We might come on to... He asked another question later about something different. He's a great talker, that's for sure. Fantastic talker. Yeah, he's a great ambassador, great player. And be interested to see how he gets on at the World Championship. That's what we're here to talk about. Now Phil's turned his phone off. Stephen Hendry, Jimmy White. I mean, you know... Well, where do you even start with that? They've been pulled out. They were the first names pulled out of the draw to play each other in the first qualifying round. I actually, Ivan, who's the head of media, the media czar at World Snooker, he texted me just before it was announced. And I thought, like Hendry, that it was a joke. Like Hendry thought it was a joke when Jill Douglas told him. I thought, oh, that's just, yeah, good gag. It's not a joke. It's happening next Monday night. A lot of people, before we get on to, we're going to talk about their Crucible battles because there's been seven in total. A lot of people asking how to watch it. At the moment, it's live on the Eurosport app. Barry Hearn was on the Talking Snooker podcast with our good friends Nick and Phil do today, and he was saying he would like it to get a wider audience, and that I think everybody agrees with that. I'll be commentating on the second half with Neil. I have no influence on anything else, so unfortunately I can't, you know, get it put anywhere else, but let's see. You know, there's a week yet. It may change, but it's certainly on the Eurosport app, as all the qualifiers are. Oh, Phil, where do you start with this? Well, let's go back to their first meeting at the Crucible, 1988, second round. Stephen was very young, he was only 19 then, and it was a bona fide classic.
Yeah, you knew then that I think the start of a rivalry had happened. It was a classic, there's no doubt about it, because I think both players played a type of game that was atypical to the circuit at that time. It was very attacking, very fast, and that's why it stood out. Apart from the quality and also the sort of future significance of it, you knew that wasn't going to be the first meeting at the Crucible. You just knew.
Yeah. They actually had a great match at the British Open, which Hendry had won only about, I don't know, 6 or 7 weeks before that. And I think they'd had a great match in the Grand Prix, perhaps, the season prior to that. So it didn't come out of the blue. We were all expecting it going into the World Championship. I remember, you know, it was almost like a feeling. I know Hendry played Dean Reynolds in the first round. I can't remember who Jimmy played, but there was a sense of, you know, don't get in the way of this. Don't go winning your first round matches or anything. Don't stop us having this Hendry White match in the second round. And so unusual to have. They were certainly two of the four best, probably two of the three best players in the world at the time. And because of the way the rankings worked at that stage, I mean, incredibly, Hendry wasn't even in the top 16 going into that match. It was his last match before he was officially sort of promoted into it. To have the meeting at that early stage of the championship was extraordinary. And it was what snooker was going to be like, not just the Hendry-White rivalry, but the sort of snooker that we were going to see throughout the 90s and beyond. Not just the fact, the size of the breaks, because I don't think Jimmy had a century.
Well, I've just looked now. So Jimmy had 11 half-centuries.
Yeah.
Stephen had 3 centuries and 7 half-centuries. So effectively, between them, they had 21 big breaks.
Yeah, so that was the point it was going to make. It was the regularity of it. It was the fact that there were no frames really at all that were, you know, without big breaks or anything like scrappy or anything like that. So it wasn't just so much the size, but I think we've seen many matches since then.
Yeah.
Well, we've seen many more centuries. But the regularity with which big breaks were being made, say 50 plus, would stack up, I think, with any best of 25 you'd see between two top players today.
Well, you'll remember this. BBC used to do, and this is how long ago it was, they used to do a Christmas retrospective of the snooker year, which of course meant their four tournaments.
Yeah.
But that year, they just showed highlights of this match, a second round match at the World Championship. They ignored everything else that had happened and been some big stuff. Doug Mountjoy had won the UK, for example. You know, Davis was world champion again, but they ignored all that. And they just showed this match because it was considered then to be extraordinary. Now it would be kind of, because we take for granted the standard, that's what we expect. But this is where it kind of started, isn't it?
Yeah, you could suspect almost that someone was supposed to be editing that together and they forgot about it till the day before and said, ah, we're meant to be doing that snooker review. Let's just put out that
one. Very cynical.
It was really... No, I'm not saying that happened. But it was strange, actually. They showed that match and then they finished it by saying... And just to round things off, here are four players we think could be big stars in the future. And I think they just showed one shot from each of them. It was probably Steve James and David Rowe and people like that. I think I was slightly going too far because, as you say, I mean, Mountjoy winning the UK. Even Henry beating Davis in the semis of that, they were very big stories. And the 9-0 Masters final. So to overlook them, I think, was taking it too far. But it was completely out of the norm for the time.
It's worth saying as well, I think Jimmy welcomed Hendry coming along because Hendry played the sort of game Jimmy liked. Now, you know, looking back now, he might not have welcomed it so much. I think it's important to say, Phil, and it's true in snooker, it's certainly true in a lot of sports, a lot of rivalries are built up based on sort of grudges and quite often hype. This is a friendly rivalry. They like each other. They're very different people. Hendry, the ultimate pro, Jimmy, the kind of, you know, the lovable tearaway, but they have huge respect for one another. It's a rivalry, and we're here talking about it, that is, you know, real, but it's not, there's no unpleasantness in it. And, you know, there's no bitterness in it either from Jimmy's perspective.
Yeah, parallels with the rivalry between John Higgins and Ronnie O'Sullivan, which is built entirely on mutual respect. There's never been any hint of angst or friction between them. Obviously, White wants to win at every single opportunity he had against Hendry, vice versa. When Hendry won one of his world titles, the 1817 one, when Jimmy missed the black, which we'll talk about later, someone asked him, well, you know, did you feel sorry for Jimmy? And Hendry said, well, if I don't win the title, he's the guy I'd like to see win, but I didn't feel sorry for him. And of course, that would be a mutual thing. It's the kind of rivalry that I would call a healthy rivalry. Mm. It's not hyped, as you say. It's not manufactured. It's real.
Yeah, but you have to pick one side or the other. You're not neutral if you're watching. This is the thing. You're either for Hendry or you're for White. Now, when I was watching them, I was for Jimmy. Because when you're young, you sort of see... I mean, Jimmy... I'm not sure he was anti-establishment, necessarily. He was just clearly... He lived life on his own terms. Now, as you get older, you begin to respect more, actually, the professionalism and the dedication that Hendry had, which is what you want to put into your own career. But when you're young, certainly I'm only speaking for myself, Jimmy seemed exciting. He seemed sort of, you know, like, oh yeah, that's a world I don't quite know about. I'd quite like to know about it.
I started in 1988 in September, so this was my last World Championship, the 88 one, where I was watching as a fan. I was with you. I was always a massive Jimmy White fan, as I was Alex Higgins before that. But when you get into the sport, what turned it for me was... And it was nothing against Jimmy whatsoever. We still got a really good relationship, I know, as you have, Dave. It was the way that Hendry was treated by spectators I thought was disgraceful, particularly at the Masters. But even at the Crucible, there have been the odd occasions where there's a few boos rung out, as they did for Steve Davis. And you think to yourself, why on earth is this happening?
Jealousy.
Exactly. Yeah. They've done nothing whatsoever to warrant being booed. And so, sort of... The curmudgeon in me sort of think, well, I'm going to be with Hendry here because it's just justice if he does well. Having said that, I think undoubtedly in all of their meetings, not just at the Crucible, I think the crowd being with Jimmy really helped Stephen because he got that personality where it was a kind of I'll show you kind of thing.
The people doing that booing are the sort of people who now spend their days on Twitter. But it's interesting, you're talking about being, you know, young, and you and I are pretty much exactly the same age, but I was completely the opposite. I was always on Hendry's side. Not so much by then, because he hadn't become this, you know, figure of sustained excellence that he later did, but certainly in the later battles, I was always much more on Hendry's side. And, you know, you and I were both still at school when all those finals were played, and I found myself very much in the minority because it was such a big deal then. Everyone was watching it, and everyone took a side. So I was very much in the minority for those. The great thing about that 88 match, actually, as I recall, it was played across three separate days, so it really spread out the drama.
Saturday morning it finished,
and I remember the rest of that day, you almost didn't want to watch it.
I think it went live on Grandstand.
Yeah, it was certainly live. It was certainly live all the way through the morning, but the rest of the day was just completely overshadowed, and you know, later in the day, was it maybe Terry Griffiths against Willie Thorne or something like that, first session. It was just, everything was such an anticlimax after what had gone before on Saturday morning.
And it was also ultimately an anticlimax for Jimmy, because obviously he wins that. Henry's already, by that point, a ranking event winner. You know, you think, okay, he's going to challenge Davis in the final. Terry Griffiths beat him in the semis. We go to 1990, they play each other in the final. I read the Snooker Seed report, actually, that I imagine Clive must have written, and he sort of said there was a certain inevitability about Henry winning. Even at the end, he said something like he didn't celebrate like a man who won the pools, but more like a man who thought this was kind of his destiny. And that just shows the cool and the absolute sort of, I don't know where it comes from, that driven character he has, but he clearly has it. The average frame time in that final was 12 minutes. Yeah. I mean, incredible, you know, and that's not just Henry, obviously, that's Jimmy as well.
Yeah, there was a certain inevitability about it. I remember that final, you just felt, Jimmy played all right, but he just couldn't keep up. It was as simple as that. And it's funny you mention that, the way he celebrated at the end. And I actually spoke to him about this a few years ago. He never seemed to know how to celebrate when he had won. It was a bit like sort of Alan Shearer when he scored a goal. He just would put his hand up in the air. He didn't really seem to know. Very similar sort of, you know, driven character as well. There was one year, I remember, at the end of the final, he just sort of took his chalk out of his pocket and started chalking his cue. I mean, you know, what's that for?
Wanting another frame.
Yeah, exactly. You're not going to be playing again for a few months in those days.
Well, let's move on, Phil, to 92, because there's two finals that people remember, let's be honest, 92 and 94. 92, even Clive, who's not a man given to hype, at one point, I think when it was 12-6, said something like, surely Jimmy's going to win it now, because he was playing really well. But, of course, the World Championship is not one match, the final, it's four sessions, and we know things changed. At the end of the third session, Henry won the last two frames for 14-10, just plants the seed, and in the evening plays, well, really well.
One of the most popular aspects of ITV coverage now, hot shots.
Mm. And then, actually.
Yeah. Mm. If there was all-time...
Same music.
Yeah. If there's all-time hot shots, the brown that Henry potted, with the cue ball in the jaws of the middle pocket, a dead weight, that would be right up there, along with a bluey potted with the rest against Steve Davis in the UK Championship final. They would be, for me, Henry's two greatest. Maybe the first red as well in the 147 in the Liverpool Victoria Charity Challenge final against Ronnie O'Sullivan. When he got back to 14-10, I started to sense that not so much that Jimmy would go, but that Henry was absolutely in the zone. And people have said, oh, White collapsed. Maybe there was a little wobble, but it was more to do with Henry's excellence. He just got the bit between his teeth and absolutely went for it. And you know what really changed? I'm not watching it from the press seats, I'm watching it from the press room, and the atmosphere in the press room just went as flat as a pancake. Myself and Clive were absolutely entranced by this, but the vast majority of the Fleet Street press, who badly wanted Jimmy White to win, they were all, it was like the air out of a balloon.
It's funny how often, isn't it, you know, when someone has got a bit of a deficit to make up in a multi-session final, and people say, well, what's he got to do here? The answer is always is, well, he's got to make a good start today. And obviously that was the case with Henry, but he actually didn't. You know, four frames behind overnight, he actually falls further behind. And I think everyone felt, this is it. I mean, White had gone in playing so well. He'd won the British Open, he'd won the European Open. He'd sort of underlined how well he was playing with the maximum in the first round. Anyone who believes in fate and destiny, I think, got a rude awakening that night, because this was not how the story was meant to end. For me, by the time it got to 14 all, I couldn't see any way back. I think the first couple of frames of the night, I think Henry made a pretty good clearance in the first. And I think he won the second of the night on the black. And at that stage, you could see already White was struggling with the concept of getting over the line. Might have been different if it had been as close as that, but he'd only needed one or two more. Suddenly, the four frames he needed, when it had been 14-8, that didn't seem very far. By the time it comes back to about 14-12, it seemed like a world of distance he still had to cover.
And let's not forget what happened in the last two frames. By the way, I'm not remembering this. I've got Chris Downer's excellent Crucible Almanac in front of me as a security blanket. In the last two frames, from 16-14 to capture the title, Henry made breaks of 134 and 112. Two beautiful efforts. It was just epitomised what he meant. He wasn't just a winner. He was a stylish, brilliant winner.
Yeah, and also that driven personality again. It's interesting we did our episode Puffery and Liars, you'll recall, about the sort of myths in snooker. I still hear people say Jimmy was 14-8 up overnight. He wasn't. He was 10-6 up overnight. But one of the things he was unable to do, and it definitely had some sort of effect, I think, on him not winning, not just against Henry, but anyone, he always had an entourage with him. And he spent too much time going around getting passes for people, spending too much time with all that scene. Whereas Hendry, as to use one of Jimmy's phrases, wouldn't give you a nod in the desert. Hendry was just on his own. He'd have John Carroll from Q Masters with him. That was it. And he was completely focused on the job in hand. And as you say, by the time the chance came to win that final, he was ready to play his best snooker of the whole tournament. I remember it turning around. You're right, Jimmy didn't. It wasn't a series of, you know, sort of missing, but there were little mistakes here and there, little safety errors even that Hendry got in from. And you just sensed, yeah, this is just going to turn around completely.
And there's a very telling shot we've all seen many times. I've no idea which frame it was in, but it was clearly near the end. It may even have been the last frame. Jimmy's actually sitting in his chair, not hiding his emotions at all, shaking his head, putting his face into his palm. He knew that he had blown it.
Yeah. So 93, this is so not. Hendry always says this is his favourite of them all, because he, as he said, I ruined the final for everyone. He won with a session to spare, 18-5. I suppose everyone had been hoping for another dramatic final. They'd have to wait another year for that. I guess that was kind of his sort of peak period, wasn't it? You know, that's when he was just the best, and he proved it by just basically hammering the guy.
And it wasn't just the final, was it? I mean, it was all through that championship. Yeah. It was a strange sort of championship that. We didn't have many memorable finishes with some very unusual players qualifying.
Well, the qualifiers have been a long time before, haven't they?
Yeah, they've been in September. Yeah. And what had happened was the guys ranked 17 to 32 had come in a bit cold against players who had been playing qualifiers all summer long. And so there were a lot of surprises. A strange championship. And we spoke about inevitability earlier. Even more so that time. The thing was, White hadn't gone in great form. He'd started that season brilliantly. Amazingly, he'd put what had happened in the 92 final behind him so well that he'd won the Grand Prix in the UK. But he'd faded a bit in the second half of the season, so he wasn't going in with the same level of expectation. But I seem to recall Hendry's first shot, and you've got the almanac there, Phil. Was it a 1-3-6 in the first frame, something like that?
It was indeed.
Yeah, and I think it may have been his first shot. He drilled one in. People forget how often this used to happen. You don't really see this now. The cue ball was on the ball cushion. He drilled in a long red. Players don't even tend to go for those now. I may be remembering that slightly wrong, but as we say, it was a total clearance in the opening frame. And it never looked like being any different after that. And what you were saying there about how, you know, he used to just keep to himself in the venue, he'd be with John Carroll, who was very good company actually, a good person to fill that role because, you know, he was all the company that anyone needed. Some people feel there's a sort of counter-argument to that, that in some way it might have been better for him to behave in a different way and win fewer world titles. It's a completely absurd argument.
Yeah. Well, let's move on then to 94. I think this is the most memorable of them all, obviously, because he went to a last frame. I mean, the first thing to say, of course, they kept on being in opposite halves. Obviously, Hendry, defending champion, Jimmy managed to be the two or three seed. So they gave us another final. I think by this point it was clear that if Jimmy wasn't going to win it soon, he wasn't going to win it, because Hendry wasn't going anywhere, was he? No one really talks about anything in the match other than the end of it. Clearly, to get to 17-all, Jimmy's played great. But ultimately, you know, as in any sport, when you get the chance, it's there to be taken, and he didn't take it. As he said himself, he twitched a black.
And let's face it, he got a start, if you like, because Stephen Hendry was playing with a broken bone in his arm. That was when he'd fallen over in the bathroom when he was 7-1 up on Dave Harold in the second round. So look at this. So he's beaten Surinder Gill in the first round, 10-1. He then goes 7-1 up on Dave Harold. He's clearly in the form, well, not of his life, but he was always in that kind of form, wasn't he? Then he breaks the bone in his arm, so he can't practice, and he never practiced throughout the championship because it was just too painful. He comes back. Harold wins the first frame. You think, this is it. No chance. The next frame, Hendry makes a beautiful 1-2-4. Cueing a little tentatively, not playing power shots because of the pain, and you think, hold on a minute, this guy can do anything. He's superhuman. So he wins that match, again, as I'll reiterate, with a broken bone in his arm, 13-2. He then beats Nigel Bond, who at the time, and through all of the 1990s, was a very capable sort, 13-8. He then beats Steve Davis in the semi-finals, 16-9.
And can I just interject there, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there was an added edge to that match, because if Davis had won it, he would have gone back to number one in the rankings.
Well, you see, Hendry, at the end, when he wins, he sort of, you can see, he sort of just stays at the table. He thinks, right, that's, that box is ticked. Now on to the final.
And it's also worth mentioning that Davis led that match 9-8. So Stephen won the last eight frames in succession. So it wasn't only Jimmy White he was doing that kind of thing against. It was Steve Davis as well. It gets to the final. I'm thinking this is Jimmy's greatest chance because Jimmy was playing some really nice stuff as well. The black will live with him forever. It was just, it was horrible to see. It was like seeing a tennis player who's never won a Grand Slam event double faulting in the last game, or a golfer who's never won a major missing a 2-foot putt on the 18th green. Horrible, horrible to see. But that apart, Hendry then made a 58 break, which is often overlooked. The pressure he was under was immense.
And yet, sorry Phil, and yet, did anyone think he would miss? I didn't. I thought he won't miss. And that's the measure of him. It was objectively a massive pressure situation, but no one expected him to miss, which says everything about Hendry.
The thing about it as well, if you look back, I mean, they were all there. There was nothing left to do, really. I think he needed seven more balls, and I don't think he needed to do much to develop the reds. They were all sitting there for him, and it just overwhelmed him. I mean, that was it. The fact that he'd been waiting so long, and he'd built it up so much. I mean, even as early as about his third final, he was talking quite openly about how devastated he'd be if he never won the World Championship, because he knew he was clearly good enough. And it just became too much for him in the end. And I mean, he didn't just miss it by a little bit. He missed it by a really long way.
But he did snooker, and he did sport in general, a massive favour, because it reminded people that there are no guarantees. If there are guarantees, it's not as impressive, it's not as dramatic, is it, when it happens? There are no guarantees. You've got to do it. You can be knocking on the door a million times, but if it doesn't open...
Yeah, and it's funny. People say that so often. It's the most wrong, oft-repeated cliche in sport, and in life generally, actually. If you keep knocking on the door long enough, it will eventually open. Well, no, it won't. I mean, if there's nobody at home, it's never going
to
open.
Sometimes you have to kick it in, don't you?
Yeah.
And he didn't manage it. And I think, well, that was, of course, he's beginning to annoy me, the incredible thing he managed to say.
Very gracious, actually, you have to say, to be making a little joke like that.
But but I think after that, maybe partly because of that, Jimmy's games did start to go. He wasn't quite contending as often for tournaments. He had a cancer scare, actually, as well, the next year. And they weren't in the different halves the following year, 95. So they get through to play in the one table, they play in the semi-final. Hendry has his maximum, only maximum in the one table. And after that, Jimmy's chances started to drift away and drift away. And eventually we get to 98 and he has to qualify, drops out of the top 16. And very much like what's just happened, there was almost a sense of inevitability. Jimmy's got to qualify first time in years and years. He's going to draw Hendry. And he does. And of course, at that point, Stephen himself, of course, he'd lost the world title to Ken the year before. He was just starting to struggle a little bit. He wasn't quite winning as many tournaments. So there's a great sense of anticipation. But again, he would have gone in favourite for sure in that first round match.
Oh, yeah. I remember that was the first year I went to the championship, but I was only there for the sort of later round, so I wasn't there for the first round. And on the night of the opening session of that match, I was at a football match between Ireland and Argentina. And I remember phoning someone, it might have been you actually, because you were press officer at the time.
Junior.
Yeah, exactly. And asking... you don't want to take responsibility for what was going on in those days. So, So anyway, I remember asking whoever it was I was talking to, I said, and what's the score in the White Hendry match? And then I think it was a bit of a lull in the match, so the crowd had gone a little bit quiet. But this huge, oh my God, just rang out around the stadium. I couldn't believe. And it wasn't even 7-0 by then. I think it maybe gone 4 or 5-0 or something. And even that seemed surprising. Because I thought Hendry was going to win the championship that year. I thought, well, I know he didn't win it last year, but the fact is he still wins it most years, and he still won a few tournaments that season.
My memory was it was two evening sessions.
Yeah.
Now he's gone 8-1 up Jimmy in the first one, and I was sat as you saw, I was like junior press officer. I was sat at the little media desk, and Jimmy came over to use the phone, and he rang. Let's say it was his wife. It was someone who, at home clearly, who knew the score. And he was sort of saying, no, it's going really well. He said, I bet he still comes back and beats me. You know, with that sort of joking, but sort of not joking at the same time. He knew that Hendry, you know, wouldn't have given it up. But then the next night, there was this mini comeback, but Jimmy wins 10-4, gives it an oi oi, Phil, as he goes off. Oi oi, he shouted. Brilliant.
One of the preceding tournaments before the World Championship then, historically, was the Irish Masters at Goffs. And
that was the first time we ever met.
Exactly. So we were there.
This could be the last time. Who knows? We don't know, do we? Yeah.
We were there, and it was a very sort of communal atmosphere, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Hendry came into the press room, and on several occasions, he said to me and to other people, "I'm going to draw Jimmy. I know I'm going to draw Jimmy." He just knew. He got that feeling, and of course, when the draw came out, it was, you know,
live on Grandstand. Actually, the draw was made. Yeah.
And by the way, this is a side issue. Why doesn't a television company take the draw for the World Championship these days? It is just ridiculous. We saw the drama when Stephen drew Matt Selt in the Gibraltar Open, and then of course it was magnified last week when ITV showed this reaction when he drew Jimmy in this year's World Championship qualifiers. Why don't they show the draw? It's mind-boggling to me.
But this conversation's been going on for 15 years. I mean, it's incredible that something as simple as the draw has taken on a life of its own. The time they messed it up when it was on the radio, the time when they recorded it and then just sort of showed the draw on BBC Breakfast, various other mess-ups, and every year it seems to be this sort of hot potato that nobody wants to handle. Maybe it's because of those things that went wrong in the past. But yeah, as you say.
And so being critical of TV companies brings me to that actual match. What I recall is
TV companies that don't employ you.
Well, there aren't many of those. To narrow it right down. Whoa, beat up TV. Yeah. That's about all that's left. Anyway.
Let's brush over that one. So it's 8-1 to White, and I'm thinking, there's no way back, even given their history. But
hang on, how can you think that? Because, I mean, the Masters final in 91, the World final in 92, having seen those, I mean, how could anyone not think that there was at least a chance that Hendry could turn it around?
I didn't, purely, and it's only because I'd observed Hendry. He came in that afternoon with Frank Callum, who was with him, the coach at the time. And Frank was Frank was a sort of man of few words anyway, but he was trying to just impart a few, and Hendry just didn't want to hear it. He looked like a man who'd lost already.
He called him a man of few words, and makes Hendry himself look like the scat man.
It's the 90s.
So he's basically the first frame of the night. White makes 59, Hendry 72, and you think, hold on a minute. Then it gets to 8-4. The tension is immense because of the past history. Normally an 8-4 match, first to 10, you still think very unlikely to get, you know, to get over the line, the guys behind. But with what had gone before, you think there's still now a real chance. What happened at 8-4? The live coverage ended to be replaced by a repeat of the Book Club. Not even
it's a good episode, in fairness.
Not even an original Book Club, a repeat of the Book Club.
So we never got to see the final chapter.
Very good.
Yeah.
We might be interrupted. Some people doing some important work. So yes, and that was obviously again a chance for Jimmy, having, you know, you think we beat Stephen Hendry in the first round, he could go all the way, but it was just a sense by then it just wasn't going to happen for him.
Well, he played great in the second round against Darren, wasn't it? Darren Morgan, 13-3 maybe. But then, I mean, you look at what he would have had to do.
That's
even
the problem. By then there were too many good players.
Yeah, because he would have had to beat O'Sullivan. Then he would have had to beat Higgins, who I think played better in that championship than anyone had ever played in any tournament up until then. And then he would have had to beat Doherty in the final, who, you know, was defending champion. And to beat him over four sessions would have been a huge challenge in itself. I never really thought he was going to see it through. I mean, people say, even a couple of years later in 2000, I think he got to the quarterfinals again. And I remember people saying, "Now this is it. It's going to be his time, the millennium year." Because people thought, because it was the millennium year, that was the thing. People thought, "Oh yeah, it's the millennium year. That's going to make a difference." I think by '98, it had gone past the stage where he was capable of keeping that going, and the standard had gone up so much, and his own standard had declined a bit. So if he couldn't win it when he was one of the very best players in the world, the chances of him doing it when he had declined a bit and everyone else had got so much better, you know, were very slim indeed. So it was all about that win for him.
Well, my last memory of that night when he won the 10-4, I mean, you can imagine the pandemonium in the press room that night. And at the end of it, because I didn't know, obviously I just started there, I didn't know Jimmy at all, other than just knowing him, as a, you know, watching him. And when he's finished his sort of media commitments, he's walking out of the press room. I was sat with Bruce Beckett, who was the sort of senior press officer.
Yeah.
And he's gone, we're going out now, you come in. And we ended up going to Josephine's, the celebrated, celebrated nightclub in Sheffield till the early hours. That was kind of my introduction to Jimmy.
Is it still there, by the way, Josephine's?
No, I don't think so. No, I think there's a blue plaque up or something. But
it'll be shut now anyway.
Yeah. But yeah, so, and now here we are, that was 23 years ago.
One really important thing about that whole scenario
What, Joseph Fiennes?
No.
Oh, yeah, like he'd know where it even was.
No. It was the fact that because Hendry lost in the first round and John Higgins won the tournament, it meant that that ended Stephen Hendry's tenure, eight-year tenure, as world number one. And that really did hurt him because, of course, it wouldn't have happened had John Higgins not won the preceding tournament. So many things had to come into play for that to occur. And it reminds me, actually, of the current situation, because if Judd Trump were to go out in the World Championship early and Ronnie were to retain the title, unbelievably, considering the lead that Trump has had for quite some time now, that could all change as well, and Ronnie could be world number one.
And Higgins had won the preceding tournament by beating Hendry 9-8 in the final. So that the final frame of the British Open final, which I think was literally only 6 days before the World Championship began, Hendry was one frame away from securing another season as number one. The thing was, it's not often mentioned now, but Hendry used to say around that time his two big ambitions were to get to the 7 world titles to overtake Davis and to have 10 years unbroken as world number one. Now, even if he hadn't won it in 99, I mean, there would still have been other chances to get that 7. But once the run at number one is over, that's it. That's gone forever. He can't turn that round. So, yeah, that hurt him enormously.
Well, here we are. So, 7 meetings at the Crucible. And as Stephen Hendry said, we played in the final. Now, here we are, rock bottom. First qualifying round. And there's something on this match, isn't there? Because if Stephen beats Jimmy, Jimmy's probably off the tour. Barring wild cards, which personally I think he will get one. He's been told apparently he won't. I don't know who's told him that, but I think
Hendry's probably told him.
Yeah, I think, but wouldn't that be like the final nail in the coffin if he actually was, if Stephen beat him and was relegated? But let's look at the match. Okay, it's there's so much around it, but they're actually playing a snooker match. Jimmy actually has started to play quite well of late. He did well in the Gibraltar Open, had a few wins in the Pro Series. They've been practicing together. That's going to have to stop. Hendry obviously just played one match in, what, 9 years, is it? 9 years? Mm. So, on paper, Jimmy's favourite, but with all this history we've discussed, I don't know. I find it very hard to actually have a view on what's going to happen.
I don't. I think Jimmy will win. Yeah, I don't give Hendry much chance at all. I think people have said, oh, he came back and he made a great comeback against Selt. He actually didn't, did he? I mean, he made a century, which was impressive, but the rest of the time...
He was outplayed, though. I don't think Jimmy's going to produce that sort of level.
Yeah, but...
I don't think anyone will in that first round of qualifying.
But you know, I mean, Hendry has spent the 9 intervening years making jokes about how bad his own safety was and then went out and kind of highlighted it in the match against Selt. And, I mean, it's bound to be. You can't come back after 9 years and get back into that competitive environment again and expect to put it up to people. So I think Jimmy will win. I think for both of them, it's a very good draw because there would be very few players in the draw you would feel Hendry would have much chance against. I think Jimmy is one of them. You know, if he's going to beat anyone, Jimmy would be one of the few, and vice versa. But I think when it comes to it, the fact that Jimmy's still been playing for all these years, and you know, has produced some good stuff recently. I mean, you look at Gibraltar and how well he played there. I would be extremely surprised. I mean, all these years later, I'm still as big a Hendry fan as ever, and I hope he wins, but I'd be very, very surprised if he does. What about you, Phil? You're an even bigger Hendry fan than I am.
Unashamedly. I'm more with Dave than with you. I've got no firm opinion as to who I think will win, but I do know one thing that will win, which is snooker, and it vindicates entirely the wild card situation. Giving Stephen Hendry a wild card has been phenomenal for the Selt match. Now it's being phenomenal because of the White match. And it also, in many respects, does Jimmy a favour because it just highlights how important it is to have these people around still, because they can create interest and still move the needle. So consequently, if he does drop off the tour and he isn't given a wild card, it's a joke, because the guy is still hugely popular and he's still great for snooker and he can do big things for it. If you give him a wild card for 2 years, if he drops off the tour, what will happen is, over those 2 years, he'll play at least 6, 7, 8 matches. The home nation springs to mind, where everybody comes in at the first round and it's on TV from the start. He'll play 5, 6, 7 matches in that 2 year period at least, where people will want to see him on television and the ratings will be good. Also, you've got to look at the wildcard situation and say, what are the alternatives? Is there anyone better to come onto the circuit in terms of interest, in terms of commercial viability? And the answer is definitely no. Give Jimmy a wild card. Absolute total sense.
The thing about that is, though, there isn't a defined number of invitational cards, so it's not a choice between him and anyone else. I don't think there's any question. I think he'll definitely get one. And if there is any doubt about White getting another 2-year card, I think this match will probably clinch it for him, because there'll be so much talk about it. I mean, we're here talking about it now. Here's the thing, and we've been accused of being a bit niche over the last year at times on here.
I'm about to take that
to new heights or depths, depending on your perspective. Is this the first time there's ever been a match on the tour between two players, both on invitational cards?
No, Jimmy played Watanabe.
Good point. That was a great match, actually.
Has there ever been... Someone asked me this, and I just sort of didn't go through. Has there ever been a world qualifying match between two people who played in the final? I think Higgins might have played Spencer 1 year, possibly, in the qualifiers. Alex Higgins, that is.
Have a quick look through the album.
I will look, but it wouldn't be quick.
We'll let you know next week. My view is I don't know, actually. I think Jimmy's favourite, but it's the extent to which he could shut out the dynamic. They're not going to be immune to it by any means, the fact they're playing each other. I do think, though, Jimmy, you've got to admire the way he's just got over it all. He's not a bitter man at all. Jimmy lives for tomorrow. He doesn't think about all of that that's happened. Of course he wanted to be world champion. He was good enough to be world champion. He should have been world champion, but he wasn't. But he doesn't... I'm sure he doesn't wake up in the middle of the night screaming about it. He just gets on with his life. He loves playing snooker. He still loves snooker every bit as much as he did back then. And if you're of a certain age, as we are, when you remember those matches, I mean, those matches are part of the reason I'm sat here now. The rivalry they had, the interest in snooker that they generated. You know, I look back at those matches, I think about, you know, the people I watched them with. You know, you think about who you were at the time. Mm-hmm. You think about who you wanted to be. And now you think about who you are. And I'm really looking forward to commentating on it. So, looking forward to it. As I say, at the moment, it's on the Eurosport app. I was thinking, actually, though, you know, I mean, how I would have loved back then to watch the qualifiers in any way. You couldn't unless you went to them. I remember you would have been there, Phil, when Alex Higgins qualified for the last time, 1994, the year that eventually we had the Jimmy missing the black in the decider. And we didn't have CFAX, which was the only real way you could find out what was happening. So I didn't know he'd qualified until I read it in the Birmingham Evening Mail the next night, basically a day later. It was too late for the morning papers. So that's how times have changed. At least now, okay, I know a lot of people would like to see it on the TVs. You can actually watch it now, and I'm sure a lot of people will be.
I remember a Welsh Open final, the first year it was a ranking event. I didn't know who had won it till a week later, when the British Open coverage came on, and they mentioned Stephen Hendry, who's just won the British the Welsh Open. He'd beaten Morgan in the final. One point we have to raise: the four finals between Hendry and White, apart from the first one, the trilogy, as it were, 92, 3 and 4, all finished on Bank Holiday Mondays.
Yeah.
And this is going to be on a Bank Holiday Monday night. I mean, I'd be astonished if it doesn't end up on TV. I mean, you know, put it on Quest, for example, and I mean, 10 million, you know, easily. Especially at the moment when everyone's all about nostalgia. I mean, what do people think of? Anyone who's got any interest in snooker, one of the first things they think of about the 1990s, as you say, particularly for people of our age who were teenagers at the time, they remember watching Hendry and White playing each other in the World Championship. 23 years later, here it is again.
You know, thinking about the absurdity of this, all of these matches are going to be streamed all over the world. You're going to be going to some countries and there'll be people sitting there, who are these two?
Yeah. Well, that's true. But hopefully listening to this podcast, they'll have found out. Phil, we can't let you go. We've sort of talked preliminarily, that's not a word.
Preliminarily?
About our sort of thoughts for who's going to be world champion. Mm. And we'll firm that up when the draw comes out, obviously. Just give us a couple of names. I mean, I think we probably know who they're going to be, but what are you thinking at the moment?
Well, okay. I'm not going to sit on the fence about this in one sense, but I am very much going to sit on the fence in another.
The championship's starting the 17th, Phil. Get on with it.
Yeah, no. So, basically...
It's an unusual fence if you're both sitting on it and not sitting on it.
So, I'm categorical in the sense that it's going to be a big name winning it. There's no doubt in my mind.
Wow. Big call.
No, because...
Hang on, Rick Kay Burley. Get it on Sky News.
Okay.
If you can find her.
There are so many really top players these days that if one or two of them lose early on, there's still a wall of them to get past. So, it will be one of the usual suspects.
Oh, my God, this is longer than the final itself. Get on with it.
Okay. I'm going to go for Kyron Wilson. as my semi-outsider. My outsider, which he shouldn't be really because of his talent, is Mark Allen. And my main pick would be...
Hang on, let me get the drum. I'm afraid that's all we got time for this week.
John Higgins.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, if he plays anything like as well as he did in the Players' Championship, I mean, that was reminiscent of 1998, I was saying earlier. He had 14 centuries then, which was the most anyone had ever made in that 98 Championship. And you thought he was going to be taking on the mantle from Hendry because he was, you know, playing Hendry's game, but playing it better than he did. It didn't quite turn out that way. It took him 9 years to win it again. He ended up becoming four times champion. But yeah, if he produces that form again, then... I absolutely agree. And the fact you put Allen in there, I am always of the mind, and maybe I'm slightly biased because, you know, both from Antrim and all that, but I mean, the fact that he's just the sort of player you could imagine, no matter what form he was in going into the Championship, and he's not really had a good season, you could just see him going there, turning it on for 2 weeks and winning it. Not hard to imagine at all.
I think I'm pretty confident, and we'll talk more near when the draw's made. If we all wrote down seven names now of likely winners, one of them would be the winner because they'll be the same people. I think it's very unlikely, based on what we've seen this season, that we're going to have a winner from the qualifiers, for example. I think it's very unlikely. Not impossible, because some good qualifiers, potentially, but it's probably going to be one of the usual suspects, just because it's a really tough event to win. You've got to play, you know, the best stuff in the world, and there's so many, you've got to beat so many other good players to do it. Obviously, Judd Trump is in the mix. Anyway, the qualifiers start on Monday. I think we're going to hopefully do a little preview around the time it starts of the whole thing, tip our 16 coming through, and obviously the Crucible starts on the 17th of April. But it's all about next week. Stephen Hendry and Jimmy White, here we are. Who'd have thought it in 2021? Looking forward to them playing again.
Yeah, and we were just talking about this earlier over breakfast, weren't we, that they met in the first round in 1998. It was the last time they played each other in the World Championship. One of the big first round stories that year as well was Ken Doherty, the defending champion, almost losing on the opening day to Lee Walker, and they're playing again in the first qualifying round.
And I'd just like to say, you know, congratulations to Jimmy for being such a wonderful force for good in snooker over the years. Regardless of the fact he hasn't won the World Championship, that is a fact, there's no getting away from it. But his career has been vastly better than a lot of people who have won the championship. Maybe not a lot of people, but certainly a few of them. And it's, for me, a little bit like Colin Montgomery in golf. Never won a major, but his career was far superior to some people who did. So let's not lose sight of the fact that Jimmy White had a great career and he's been a great force for good for snooker.
Yeah, and just on the invitational cards thing, I think, you know, in one sense, scrap it, but in another sense, firm it up.
Yeah. Give it some clarity.
Yeah, what I would like to see is, and again, you know, another golfing comparison, I mean, you see this in golf, make people lifetime members. You know, just say to someone, once you've got to a certain stage, you're a lifetime member, you're on the tour, or have a career money list, something like that. I'm all for these guys being on the tour, 100%, but I actually think it should be, we shouldn't be sitting here discussing whether or not White will get on for another 2 years. I think it should be in the bag already.
Well, just to wrap it up, it's worth saying as well, we've just talked about the World Championship. Jimmy actually beat Hendry in other finals and other matches, but we all think, especially this time of year, the Crucible. And the one thing about the match is one of them's going to be in the second round. So one of them is going to get a little bit closer to potentially walking out there again.
Could you really see it, either of them, winning four matches?
Well, Joe Long is waiting in that line. So that's already, that's trouble, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to stop there. You can email us, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. We've had a lot of emails in the last week. We're going to get to them next week, hopefully. But that's it. We've given our all on Jimmy and Stephen. I'm sure they'll give their all next week. I think we're all looking forward to it. We'll see you very soon. Sports Social Podcast Network.